This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respect to their elders past and present.
You bastard!
No! For a film that was forgotten, it is unforgettable.
Some might say it has a hellish feel about it.
I don't know how to explain my first viewing of it, other than I loved it and I was shaken by it.
The feel and look really captures the tactile nature of the Australian environment.
It's now become a classic of Australian cinema, but for years it faded into obscurity and was nearly lost forever. Wake in Fright is a psychological horror that paints a damning portrait of a certain kind of Australian culture. It's set in the fictional outback town of Bundan Yabba, or the Yabba. The original novel and inspiration for the film is coloured by author Kenneth Cook's alienating experiences in the real town of Broken Hill in far west New South Wales. When English teacher John Grant finishes his term at an isolated one-classroom school, he starts on a long train journey to Sydney. There, he plans to meet his girlfriend. But things take a dark turn when he gambles away all his money during an overnight stop in the Yabba. The aggressive hospitality of the townspeople leads him down a path of incessant drunkenness and violence as he struggles to escape the Yabba's vast, stifling emptiness and its toxic social existence.
The boys made you present with a gun.
I'm Dylan Bird, and this is the first episode of Seeing Green, a podcast exploring how Australian cinema has shaped our relationship to our natural environment. In this series, we're asking, could Australian film help us to imagine new ways of addressing our most urgent environmental challenges? In this episode, we're looking at Ted Kotcheff's 1971 film adaptation of Wake in Fright. We're exploring what this film reveals about contemporary environmental issues, like climate change, species loss, and the enduring impacts of colonialism. And we're bringing in two experts from different fields to help us do this, film studies and environmental studies. Joining me in this discussion is our film expert, Associate Professor in Film and Screen Studies at Monash University, Belinda Smail. She's also one of our executive producers. Hi, Belinda. How's it going?
Hi. Good, thanks.
And can you tell us a bit about your research interests and why you wanted to make this podcast series?
Yes, sure. So I'm currently working on a project funded by the Australian Research Council that really looks at a longer history of how, in particular, non-fiction film and television has shaped our attitudes towards the Australian environment. And I'm really interested in how the environment has become kind of this contested idea and how film might play a role in that. And the podcast was really about trying to bring some of these questions to a broader audience. And we thought looking at quite well-known examples of Australian fiction film was a good way to spark debate and get some questions posed about how we can revise our understanding of Australian cinema, because we haven't really thought about the environment in relation to these films. We've talked a lot about landscape, but that's quite a different kind of idea. And what happens if we think about the actual reality of the environment, of Australian ecologies, and how they feed into our kind of cinematic imagination?
So is that part of the reason for wanting to bring together people from quite different disciplines, not just film and cinema studies, but from environmental science, ecology, and whatever else?
Yes, exactly. So we have so much expertise in Australia, and we wanted to take kind of a new and maybe even surprising approach to some films that many people know so well and have been talked about at some length. You know, what happens when expertise butts up against each other?
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to being surprised through making this series in a good way, of course. Wonderful. Thanks so much. And also joining us today is Chris McCormack. He's a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne researching conservation psychology. He's also got a background in ecology and marine biology, and he's the co-founder of the nature charity Remember the Wild. Hey, Chris, it's great to have you here.
Hi, Dylan. Thanks so much for having me. It's a real privilege.
And so give us a bit of a sense of your work and research background.
Well, as you said, I've got a background in ecology, so I've studied zoology and marine biology. And currently I'm studying, I guess, how environmental storytelling can persuade people to care about our ecosystems and the planet. And I'm really interested in, I guess, the storytelling element and how that connects with human nature relationships and can interact with that. So in terms of my work background, I've spent a fair bit of time out in the bush and out in the outback exploring these places and enjoying them, and very privileged in that respect. And yeah, so it's always a joy to be able to talk about them in any way.
Yeah, and a perfect candidate for being involved in this podcast by the sounds of things.
Yeah, we'll find out by the end, won't we?
That we will. Wonderful. Well, it's great to have you both here. So let's get stuck into our discussion. Belinda, how would you describe the look and feel of Wake in Fright?
Well, some might say it has a hellish feel about it. The feel and look really captures the tactile nature of the Australian environment. The light is very bright. There's dust. You can feel the dust on the characters' clothes and skin. There's flies. There's heat. So I think it's an interesting film in terms of really provoking a kind of sensory experience, as much as film can do about that, a sensory experience of the Australian outback.
The Australian outback has been quite a familiar setting for Australian film. Is there anything particularly unique or different about the way it's represented in Wake in Fright, do you think?
Well, Wake in Fright is a very important film for Australian film history because it really achieved something quite different. It's, in some ways, it's a very modest film. It's relatively low budget. It was forgotten for years after it was made. But it comes at the beginning of the Australian film revival. So before this, there weren't a lot of Australian-made feature fiction films in Australia. So it sparks a new way of thinking about the outback, really.
You got a fear, eh, Doc?
Hey, Joe, take a look at this. It's a beauty.
Yeah. Yeah, you must be a seven-footer for sure. Go on, Dick, we better cut up a few for the dogs, eh?
Thinking about this film and watching it again, it struck me that there's often really intriguing stories about how people first came across this film, and maybe that speaks to the fact that it was presumed lost, you know, forever potentially, and didn't really initially catch on in Australia. It had some success in France and overseas. But I remember going to see this in 2009 when it had just been reissued, not long after the negatives had been rediscovered. It was one of those spur of the moment type decisions where it happened to be on at the right time when I was at the cinema. I had no preconceptions, no knowledge about the film at all. Came out an hour and a half later in a complete daze, and I feel like I'm still in a lot of ways processing that experience. Chris, what was your first experience with this film? How did you come across it, and who introduced you to it?
I was filming with a colleague at the time. Possibly we might have even been in Broken Hill or travelling in that area, which of course is where the film was shot. He said, "Have you seen Wake in Fright?" And I said, "No, what's that?" And, you know, he said, "Well, you need to watch it." And, yeah, sure enough, I did. And I think you put it really well, Dylan, the idea that you're still processing what that experience was. That I agree, you know, I'm still... And it is, for a film, as has been discussed already, that was forgotten, it is unforgettable. Like, it is just so memorable. It hits many notes, and I don't know how to explain my first viewing of it other than I loved it and I was shaken by it.
Did watching the film change or sort of alter your impression and experience of those places that you then came to visit?
Well, you know, I grew up in country Australia, so I think I've always had a connection with these places, and it sits with you, this film. It sort of rides around on your shoulder when you visit those places, you know, and kind of whispers in your ear a little bit about what are the dark undertones here that may or may not be. But I wouldn't say it's, you know, changed the way I view rural people and country people. And I think that the interesting thing about the film is that there's not just a sort of a darkness that's shown. There are these kind of values that are championed by country Australia, and they do come through, but then there's this twisted side of it as well. So I think, I honestly am still processing it. Like you said, I think it's a looming cloud of question marks, I think, is what it is. That's what I carry around with me.
Yeah, it's good to know there's others out there who are still processing it as well. That makes me feel a little bit better.
Yes, better.
Thanks, mate.
Belinda, how significant is it that this film was shot in Broken Hill?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question because, well, it's very significant, I'll say, to start with. But also, one thing we should know about the film is that the exterior shots were shot in Broken Hill, but much of the interior shooting was produced in Sydney, including pub scenes and, you know, indoor, you know, inside houses and famous shack in the film. So that, I think, is something that can influence our kind of understanding of the film is located in Broken Hill and what the extent the filmmakers went to reproduce the Broken Hill environment in Sydney.
Thought I lost you, mate.
You know, Broken Hill is really significant in a number of ways. Since the film was made in 1970, it's become a very important film location for a number of well-known films, including many films in the Mad Max series. But of course, Broken Hill is also this, you know, Broken Hill Petroleum Mining Company. It's a very well-known mining area. So it has a really interesting culture in terms of film production, a destination in films, and a backdrop, a kind of nowhere backdrop location that makes it quite interesting.
It struck me re-watching the film that mining doesn't really play a big part, but there is, towards the beginning, a montage, you know, that includes a few different shots of mines. Do you think that there is a clear relationship in this film between resource extraction and the kind of harsh, violent social reality that the film depicts? Maybe we'll pivot over to Chris. What do you think?
Oh, look, the sense that pervades me when I watch that film is just that the environment is something to be used. The surrounding shots, I guess, that Belinda's talking about, you know, those environmental shots, there's this sense of nothingness, which is just an incredibly Western colonial perspective to have on that region. It is an amazing ecological area of the world, and there's just this sense of nothingness and being surrounded by nothingness and trapped by nothingness, and the only time the environment is interacted with is as a playground or as something to be extracted from or as a you know, as some kind of violent, wasteful sport. So yeah, I do think there's a link there. Yeah, it's this strange dynamic where the environment creates the people, but they're really sort of created by the way they treat it, I guess. You know, it's they're trapped in their own perspective, I would say.
The first shot in the film is, you know, an incredible, more than a minute, single take of that. That's a 360-degree pan around kind of the outback, showing almost nothing, you know, in terms of trees and this incredible depth of field as well, where you can see very far into the horizon. And of course it's meant to connote remoteness and isolation. But if we step back, and as Chris kind of suggested, and think about it as an environment, there's actually an incredibly rich ecology out there. The remoteness is the fact that it is remote for humans, and for John Grant in particular. So this is a shot that sets up his kind of psyche at the beginning of the film. And he eventually finds, of course, these horrendous characters, these very dark situations that he can't escape from. And the question of whether the film is about how the environment acts on humans to perform a particular way, or these particular kinds of people are attracted to this kind of ungoverned situation in this remote area, I think is another interesting question that is unresolvable, of course, in the film. We don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. To what extent does that suggest that, you know, there's a real critique of colonization in this film, with a sense that those who have been created or have come to live in this bizarre, wretched social reality, men particularly, because, you know, the vast majority of characters in this film are men. Do you sort of read that as in any way a critique of colonization as creating this deformed social reality, or rather that, you know, these people in this environment that's so harsh and dry and unforgiving have had to find a way to live amidst those kinds of conditions? How do you read that through that lens?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, one of those possibilities is the bigger kind of situation of colonial Australia, of being out of place, which is one way of reading the film. not in the right place. And I would say being out of sync with the natural environment, not knowing how to get into sync with it, they're kind of struggling the whole time with the elements. And in terms of the other part of your question, it's a question of who ends up in these places. Either they've got a longer history in terms of being settled in the area, or they've, you know, as with many mining towns, travelled there because that's the opportunity. So those are two different questions, I think. There's the kind of cultural, social forces, and then there's the bigger national picture that we can think about this in relation to.
I really agree wholeheartedly, and I think it's, you know, the main town, the fictional town where this takes place, you know, Bundan Yabba, I think the Yabba, that's to me a reference to sort of some kind of fictional indigenous name, you know, that so many of these towns do have indigenous names out in rural Australia, and yet the only shots of first Australians are sort of in these situations where, you know, they're at, you know, we've got the man at the front of the train who's kind of, you know, he's displaced from this camaraderie of drinking at the back with these white, you know, jingoistic blokes. And that's what strikes me, is that area where the film is actually shot has a rich human culture of tens of thousands of years of people who understood the environment, and it certainly wasn't a landscape of nothingness to them. So, yeah, it is a really interesting perspective to me, my interpretation being that we as settler colonizers, we as Western people can be trapped by our own perspective or lack of openness to engage. And as someone with an ecology background who's been to those kind of areas, oh, every tree is just another fascinating landmark to approach and to see what, you know, the next birds and things like that. But of course, it's all treated as this homogenous, hot sort of nothingness in the film.
So in that scene, John Grant wakes up at Doc Tyden's house with a pounding headache. He's very dishevelled. He stumbles to the kitchen where Doc's cooking up a meal of kangaroo, and he offers John a drink. As we hear, John says, "I'd like some water," and Doc says, "No, in the Yabba, the water's only for washing," insinuating it's not for drinking.
Yabba water's only for washing. Go on, drink it up. A bit flat.
There's very little actual water in this film. The whole film is sort of scorched, apart from, of course, beer. It's literally sort of overflowing with beer. What do you make of that, given that it takes place mostly in the desert, where water, you'd imagine, would be quite a precious commodity and integral to survival?
Like, this is such an interesting scene in the film, and getting to know Doc Tyden even more. I mean, this kind of comes back to the sensory experience of the film. It's a very dry area. You can feel the dryness of the hangover, and yet there is more beer. The beer flows, you know, over and over in the film. It becomes this kind of aggressive assertion. Water is kind of repressed as a valuable resource in the film. It's kind of not the main concern for these for these characters, and yet it must be integral to their survival. But it's beer that is the liquid that kind of fuels social situations and the hostility there. I mean, I guess you'd think of then that the rest of the environment is kind of aligned with water, but these monstrous humans are aligned with beer as a kind of symbol of civilization, maybe.
Yeah, they have an insatiable thirst, even though it's you know, so often quenched just with beer and loads of it. What do you think about that idea, Chris?
Yeah, I love that concept. I mean, it's, yeah, the thing that could help them most, that kind of metaphor for the environment, water, they turn their back on, and they continue to, you know, become thirstier and thirstier by engaging in practices that sort of just trap them deeper and deeper in the spiral of what it is that they're all experiencing. And I completely agree that it makes you feel hungover watching it. The whole film makes you thirsty, and it's just it is vivid. Yeah, it's a fantastic scene.
One more beer, thanks, Joyce.
The really sort of infamous scene from this film is the kangaroo shooting scene. It happens at kind of the dramatic climax.
The big fella just won't go down, John.
The drama from that, as well as just being very difficult to watch, is because the shooting itself was real. The film crew headed out with actual hunters, and the footage we see of kangaroos being shot is real. Chris, what's your interpretation of this scene, both in the context of the film's plot and in the fact that the footage itself is real?
Look, it's, you know, I think it's probably a, even if you've never experienced something like that in real life, and you know, crikey, it is difficult to watch. And it, you know, it does feel like it goes forever, that sequence. I think a lot of people watching can relate to this kind of aggressive or violent idea of nature and the Australian bush as this shooting ground, this violent kind of playground for certain people in our community. There is a feeling of that, whether it's accurate or not. And there are people that treat it that way. This is sort of the depiction of the worst of it. But of course, as you say, everything we're watching is real. And when you read about what actually happened behind the scenes, you know, the hunters did have a bit of whiskey or bourbon, and their shots did become less and less fatal. And you see that. You see these animals. Yeah. And, you know, I think the director, Kotcheff, has said that 75% of the stuff isn't in the film, and it's much worse than what we see. So it is a real depiction in that respect. It is almost, you know, a horrid sort of documentary in those few couple of scenes. And there's nothing to be gained from the environment for us, you know. There's nothing to be gained other than a bit of sport and to displace our anger and resentment and sort of all these misplaced feelings on it. That's all it's worth, you know. These animals don't matter as individuals. They're not a part of an ecosystem. They're not a part of their own families.
See the way the roo's trying to draw him in so he can get back up on his tail, see?
Yeah, then he rips his guts out with his hind legs.
Look, it's a really shocking scene. I can't watch it. I guess to step back and see the film in its context. I mean, this is obviously one of the scenes that's most discussed in relation to the film. And Wake and Fright did have an international circulation. It was seen, you know, more outside of Australia when it was released than inside, because international audiences were more interested in it. But thinking about the kind of idea of the Australian environment that circulated at the time, I think it's also interesting to note that in the late 60s, we see the rise of Skippy the kangaroo, you know, as being a very kind of iconic Australian television representation. And then we see something like the depiction in Wake and Fright of the kangaroo shooting scene, which is just horrendous and kind of exemplifies the horror of the whole film and the kind of monstrosity of these people. So that kind of shift in the idea of Australian nature and how it's portrayed to the world is just, like, you know, incredibly, incredibly marked. And I guess it is something interesting to look back on now in terms of animal rights debates, you know, a big debate over whether we should be culling kangaroos or whether we should go for a more animal rights kind of position.
Yeah, and how do you interpret that final tile of the film right at the end, I think just before the credits, Chris, where there's a note saying that the Australian kangaroo, I'm not sure if there's any other kangaroos around the world, is a threatened species. I mean, what do you make of their decision to include that at the very end of this film, given, I suppose, that they were thinking about it, not just an Australian audience, but an international audience as well?
The general conversation from an ecological science perspective is that kangaroo abundance has increased with settlement, with, you know, the clearing of forests and the opening up of sort of agricultural grasslands, and then, you know, bringing water resources to outback areas that might not have had them previously. So I'm interested to know what the situation was at the time the film was shot. The funny thing about, the Australian kangaroo, as you say, is the species depicted, I would think, is the red kangaroo. We have several species of kangaroo in Australia, so there's no Australian kangaroo. That's not an animal.
I'm thinking about the koala bear just as something that's not true, but that's not maybe not the best analogy.
Yeah, well, it's like saying the Australian possum, right? And we know that we've got various possums. So it's that kind of thing. So it's a weird title.
And there's a scene too just before they head out for that horrific nighttime drunken shooting session where they're sitting on the porch of an outback pub and they spot a fox. And they all get up and start shooting at the fox. And John Grant eventually hits it and then runs out to retrieve the fox. And they say, no, that's a mangy old thing. You know, that's how they come out here.
It's no good skinning them, mate. They're all mangy out here. Go and drink a beer.
The searing heat of the desert really pervades this film and gives the sense of the place being quite uninhabitable or certainly, you know, very difficult to live within. And we see John Grant's skin become progressively more sort of blistered and red as the film progresses. I just felt like jumping in a pool after watching it again this time around. But obviously awareness about climate change, global warming has monumentally shifted since the early 70s. What do you make of the way that this film depicts the environment and the Anthropocene, I suppose? Is there a way of reviewing this film through the lens of contemporary awareness about climate change and potentially the catastrophic future that awaits us if we don't really heed the warnings that are there to see and start to really do something about this?
Yeah, look, there's a mixed message in relation to this. I mean, you have a character like Doc Tyden who's kind of living in a symbiotic relationship with the environment and outside of capitalism, because he states at one point in the film that, you know, he doesn't have any money and he relies on his friends, and then he sits down to a dinner of kangaroo meat. You kind of infer that it's come from some kind of hunting trip. So there seems to be a kind of devaluing of the environment around them, and yet in many ways it sustains them, like it sustains them economically, but you kind of infer in terms of food, but that's kind of repressed in this very offhand relationship to the environment. The characters are horrible, but they seem to have this hatred and yet a hatred of something that they rely on.
Mm, what do you think, Chris?
Oh, look, I find it very triggering. I find it, my partner and I live off-grid on, you know, so the other side of the divide, so we're sort of in the arid. It's getting towards the arid north of Victoria, and we're in the bush out here, and we only have rain if it falls. And I sort of, we know that climate is coming south. And so I watch this film and I go, oh God, am I going to wake up one day and look out and see this kind of environment? And, you know, obviously part of that would fascinate me. But yeah, there is, I think there is that sense of, you know, something that was filmed in the 70s, is it actually a glimpse of the future? Well, many more people. And, you know, as we're talking about, what does it say about our ability to cope with that kind of world, or engage with it, and or not engage with it, turn our backs on it and go in the pub when the pub's supposedly shut, you know? So there's all sorts of places like that around the country at the moment. And yeah, it's fascinating the different discussions you hear in these pubs. You know, some people don't refer to climate change. Some people refer to deteriorating weather patterns, their own spin on it. Yeah, I've had interesting chats in different parts of arid Australia. And yeah, as one person said to me, what are you worried about? The climate's bloody great. We love the climate here. It's bloody great. And I said, well, how's the farm? And he goes, oh, it'll kill you. So it's these two, you know, how do you maintain those two worldviews at the same time? With the beer in hand, apparently, but yeah.
I'm imagining this conversation going down in the Yabba, Chris. It all sounds sort of too familiar, having just rewatched this film. Belinda, what do you make of the fact that there has been a resurgence of this film, not just talking about 2009 when it was shown at, you know, cinemas around the country again, but there's been a television remake, there's been theatre productions and the like. Do you think that speaks to the sense that we do have a lot to learn from some of the core themes this film raises in relation to the environment itself, but also Australian culture and what happens if we don't properly grapple with our surroundings and live in more harmony with both people and animals.
If we were to see Wake and Fright afresh from our, you know, contemporary eyes, I think I would go back to kind of considering that idea of humans being out of sync with the environment, not fully knowing what is valuable, such as water. The sense of not knowing how to be in the environment or in these communities, you could think about that from a kind of Anthropocene point of view, that we're in a state of crisis, but we don't know how to be. And the film offers us a kind of imaginary of an extreme environment where humans are not coping, or they're resorting to their own versions of the of extreme in terms of behaviour. So I think it's a really interesting film to kind of pull out some of those ideas about crisis and how humans might respond to it, and feed that back into our contemporary imagination about what the future might look like. Dystopian narratives are so good for thinking along those lines, yeah.
Yeah, I've got a really unfair question for you, Chris, and this is stemming from your experience with Remember the Wild. If you could imagine what a sort of contemporary Australian feature film might look like that does engage with our current circumstances regarding climate change and associated issues of species loss and ecological management and that sort of thing, what would that look like? I mean, how can fictional film prompt a re-engagement and a growing awareness of these issues to potentially result in productive change?
Oh, I'm still working on the thesis, but
I said it was unfair.
Look, I think I'm actually really looking forward to Australian cinema in the next 10 years, because I think the stuff that has started to, you know, bubble out in the past decade has been really fascinating to watch. And the conversation in this country has evolved so much. And of course, there's certain elements that are still dragging their heels, but that is a part of the conversation. So yeah, it would be interesting to see what comes of it.
I think one of the important aspects about seeing this film in a historical context is that the films that came before it, there weren't many fiction films, but there were a lot of documentaries in the middle part of the 20th century that celebrated the Australian environment in terms of resources that it could bring to, you know, post-war economic growth, hydro, mining, and so on, agriculture. So it was about how great we were as a settler, white settler colonial culture, at using the land, mastering nature and turning it to, you know, the new technologies of post-war rebuilding. So there was a really strong narrative in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And then, you know, Wake and Fright was the first film to really show us the reality of living in the outback in a different way. If it's, you can call it reality, it's not really a realist film, but it showed us a much darker perspective on the Australian environment and humans' relationship to it, white colonial settler culture relationship to it, I should say.
Do you mean you don't think the Yabba is the greatest little place on earth?
Could be worse.
How?
Supply of beer could run out.
I think it took a different creative vision. It took a film that was more interested in kind of an interesting narrative, the psychology of characters, and kind of doing something that was a little bit unexpected, whereas the films previously had a narrative that was government-sponsored, it was sponsored by industry, it was about educating a public. But once you start getting into a different kind of milieu of filmmaking, you have different possibilities. So I think that was one aspect, that we didn't have a feature film industry in Australia to speak of. So we didn't have creative people thinking in this way and on screen in terms of the moving image.
Well, it's been really great conversing with you both and teasing out some of the sort of seminal themes from Wake and Fright. I thoroughly enjoyed re-engaging with the film, but glad I don't really have to do so for a little while yet. I might go to the pub and take a load off to process watching that film again. But thanks so much for your time, Belinda and Chris. It's been great having you on Seeing Green.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. It's been excellent. Thank you.
Seeing Green is made at Swinburne University of Technology and Monash University, and is supported by an Australian Research Council Discovery Grant. Our executive producers are Professor Therese Davis and Associate Professor Belinda Smale. Production and mixing by Britta Jorgensen. Music by Ash Sterling and hosted by me, Dylan Bird. In the next episode of Seeing Green...
From there, the story grew in his mind that he was going to create this world of car gangs and car stunts and car crashes.
I wonder if we'll have a turn in Australian filmmaking that is like, actually, let's all admit we're from the suburbs, they're dull, they're boring, they're daggy, and you need a car to get around.
I can't believe how much beer there is in that film. It just makes me want to, oh, it's just like, no more beer. Just stop with the beer.